Hey, it's Francis. Hey, a couple of weeks ago, I got to spend time with Kenji Lopez all at an event, and it was great. We were having a great time. He was telling me all about like how much he loves fly fishing while I was literally sitting by a pool eating cake and potato chips and doing nothing else. Anyway, it reminded me of this wonderful event we did together live on stage in Seattle a while back, so we wanted to share that with you again. Have a listen.
I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM. So a couple of months ago, we got to take our show on the road, finally. We landed in Seattle, and we were so excited to dig in. And eating all the great food, of course, but also dig into what makes Seattle really special as a food scene. Its sense of community. So we had this amazing evening hosted by KUOW in front of a packed crowd at the Benaroya Ilsley Ball Nordstrom Recital Hall, an amazing venue, and no, I did not get to hear the origin of that name. Anyway, we spent the night talking about not just what's delicious in Seattle, but some of the ways the food scene there really connects communities. Our first guests for the night were Ruby DeLuna, a longtime reporter for KUOW, and new Seattleite Kenji Lopez-Alt, author of The Food Lab, The Walk, and the most pro-Seattle food Instagram feed out there. And I started by asking Ruby how the food scene has developed there over the last few decades.
So I came to Seattle in 1984 from Taiwan. And what I remember was that Seattle was, it felt like a small town. Like it wasn't as bustling like Taiwan, like Taipei was where I grew up. And so picture a small town with big city aspirations. That's what Seattle was like. And Boeing was the big company in town. Microsoft, Starbucks, Costco, Amazon, they weren't even household names at all. So imagine what the food scene was like. Seattle was still trying to find its identity, its culinary identity at the time. Mm. But at the same time, behind the scenes, there were some people who were changing things. There was a fellow by the name of John Rowley.
Oh.
A lot of, yeah, chefs who remembered him called him the culinary evangelist. In my mind, he was like the seafood ambassador because he was the one who introduced chefs to local ingredients, to the bounty in our backyard. Things like Copper River salmon, Walla Walla onions, the matsutake mushroom, you know, all these wonderful things that were just, they were here in our backyard. And, you know, it was hard to resist his enthusiasm. And so chefs were paying attention. And right about that time, there was this group of chefs like Tamara Murphy of Brasa. I don't know if any of you remember her.
Oh, yeah.
Tom Douglas, you know, who started Dahlia Lounge, Palace Kitchen, you know, and Jerry Traunfeld of the Herb Farm, right? So in my mind, these chefs actually not only embrace the local ingredients, but they also embrace the growing Asian community and their food influence. I mean, they started putting things on the menu that showed that influence, whether it was like the lobster shiitake pot stickers, shiso crab cocktail, that sort of thing. So you could see them embracing like local ingredients and all these influences in the city. And when that happened, that really helped define what Northwest cuisine was. They put Seattle on the culinary map. For sure.
Yeah. Kenji, let me come to you for a second. So you moved here in late 2020.
November of 2020.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, as I was following your adventures on Instagram, pretty much it seemed immediately when you arrived in Seattle, you started really diving in. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I remember seeing you, like, eating off the hood of your car, you know. Right. I just found this really incredible.
Those are COVID dates, because the hood of the car is 6 feet apart. And it's one person on each side. Yeah.
So, you seem to have this really intentional, active exploration of, you know, at that time mostly takeout food that you were getting in the city, and I started to wonder, do you have a method? Like, okay, here you are, right? Like, you're a food professional.
Yeah.
You've lived and cooked and worked in other food-loving cities before. And, like, how do you dive in? Like, where do you start? Like, what is your method for exploring a city?
I mean, it's largely down to listening to people. And, I mean, particularly listening to, like, locals. So, I mean, you know, it starts with, like, this is the neighborhood I'm going to be living in. So let me go to some of the local restaurants and see, and if I find something I like, you know, I have this policy of, like, if I go somewhere and I don't like it, I just don't write anything about it, you know. But if I find something and I love it, then I post something about it, and then generally I try and solicit responses from people from that. It's like, I love this teriyaki here, like, where else should I go get teriyaki? It's the same way I do sort of any kind of, I guess, writing and journalism. It's like you try and plug in with people who know what they're talking about and try and get a general consensus of opinions, and then also try and pay particular attention to people whose opinions have proven to be good in the past, you know, like other, you know, whether it's a chef or a food writer or just a friend, you know.
There is this really fascinating project that you've sort of embarked on, right, which is, okay, if I'm going to live in this place, I want to, like, certainly on one level, I would just want to find, you know, what's delicious so I can go keep eating it. But, like, I think of when I first moved to New York in 1999, and I would pick up the Village Voice, and I would read this column by this writer named Robert Sitzema, and his whole thing was he would go to restaurants outside of Manhattan.
Right.
He would go anywhere in the city, but, like, you know, most of the big restaurant critics essentially focused on, you know, one part of the city, and he would go to lots of different neighborhoods, lots of immigrant communities. And for me, I started to realize at some point that, just by reading this column for years, like, Robert Sitzema mapped out New York City for me.
Mm-hmm.
You mean, like, my mental map of how this city works? Like, it's not just, this is an amazing Colombian restaurant, but that's a whole Colombian neighborhood. And, like, so now I'm starting to understand, like, how immigration patterns work and, like, where people are and, like, how the city kind of lives and functions sort of side by side with one another. So I'm just curious about your exploration of Seattle and, in what way has your exploration created a map of Seattle in your mind?
Well, you know, so one example I can give you that happened to me early on was I wanted to find really good fish and chips in Seattle, right? So one of my projects was, like, I want to find really great fish and chips. And so obviously there's you know, like the Ivars and the you know, the sort of classics. But then I go down to Columbia City to Emerald City Fish and Chips. I was like, they do this, like, cool thing with these Cajun fries. And then I go to, like, Alki Beach and get fish and chips there, and then I go down to, like, the Burien Fish House, and, like, these are all places where people are like, I can't believe you came all the way down to my neighborhood. And I was like, I don't know what your neighbor, like, I don't know anything about Seattle. Like, I'm just like, I want to find fish and chips. I'll drive half an hour to get it because I don't have anything else to do right now. It's like, I work from home. I can take an hour long lunch break and drive somewhere to get fish and chips. So early on, like, I felt like, almost like, like, having no real knowledge of the geography or anything was, like, super helpful, because if someone tells me, go to this place, it's really great, then I'm like, all right, I'll go there. But you know, part of it was also that I was a restaurant owner, right? And I was a chef in San Mateo. And you know, and so I knew, like, when the pandemic hit, what was happening to restaurants also. And so it did feel like, all right, I'm moving to the city. Like, I've got this platform. I've got this desire to explore this city. So, you know, I can marry those two things and help people. You know, I know the industry is struggling, right? So any voice that can boost it and get people going out and feeling comfortable going out to places or feeling excited about going out to places would be a positive thing also. So it felt sort of serendipitous in that sense, that it's like, it gives me this opportunity to explore the city while also promoting businesses that are having trouble right now. Yeah.
And there was, like, a measurable effect when you would show up in places. I won't embarrass you. I promise you I will not embarrass you about this. But Ruby, maybe you want to speak to what was actually coined Kenji effect.
The Kenji effect, Actually, Kenji's visits to these different businesses, attracted a lot of attention, and businesses saw business go up. And I know this because I follow you on Instagram. And then also it was written about in the Seattle Times, and you know, it's true that people have appreciated your recommendation. Even locals, or even people who've been here a long time, they would say, oh my gosh, I didn't know that place existed, and I live here.
Yeah, dog.
Yeah.
So nice work.
Why do you think that happened? I mean, I guess what I mean is, again, I live in New York. We are famously contemptuous of anyone who shows up and tries to tell us anything about ourselves. And yet, Kenji was embraced.
Yeah.
And seen as a cheerleader. Like, it was a way of, you know, his sort of outsider's perspective letting people see themselves again. And so I'm curious why you think, like, what is it about this place that embraced that to that degree?
I think it's because, you know, yeah, it is nice to have an outsider or a newcomer affirm what you're doing, right? And then in these times, especially, you know, to, I don't know, it just makes people excited for some reason, you know, like, yeah, you know, and it makes people want to share, well, you should also check this other place too. Mm-hmm. It's just as good. And so it just creates this nice, lovely conversation and exchange of ideas. You know, and that's what community building is about.
That's actually one thing I've noticed more in Seattle than like virtually anywhere else I've lived is that businesses seem super supportive of each other. So if I go to like, you know, Post Alley Pizza, which is great. I told you to go to Post Alley Pizza. Right? Post Alley Pizza is great. And I go and I say like, hey, they have like possibly the best slice of pizza. That's on their sign, possibly the best slice in the town. But I wrote that on Instagram, and then they're like, oh, but you should also check out Slice Box. You should check out these places that are also doing great slices. And it's like, you don't see that, like, you don't see that often in other cities. It reminds me in some ways of, you know, I lived in Boston for 10 years, and it reminds me a little bit of Boston in the sense that it has everything you want in a big city, but it also feels like neighborly, and it feels like a small town, you know? It feels like, in Seattle, there are neighborhoods to visit, but it also feels like I can walk down the street, go to Cafe Lago, get a Negroni, get their little appetizer, like their eggplant and their oven roasted tomatoes, and feel like I'm not like I didn't just waste a Friday doing that. You know, it's like this is a perfect Friday. I can do that, which I really love.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it has like a
so there's
a neighborly
like a lack
feeling.
Of FOMO. That
yes.
actually makes it so you
well,
feel...
Well, yeah, and I don't mean that in like a, oh, there's nothing going on in Seattle.
No, I get it, but like, yeah, no, it's not a pressurized environment where like you feel like... You know, there is a competitive, there's a performative competitiveness, right, that sort of
yes.
exists in any kind of subculture. And here where it can be much more human-scaled and much more like person-to-person, it just feels like there's a real... it's much more about human connection than it is about... you know, whatever bizarre, twisted things go on in foodies' minds.
Yeah.
All right. So that's a weird note to end on. But, we're going to edit this, and it's going to end much better.
Probably it does mean that the pizza here is like $5 or $6 a slice instead of $1 a slice because of the lack of competition. But that's a different story.
Booze. The first booze of the evening.
worth every penny.
All right, so ladies and gentlemen, Kenji Lopez-Alt, Ruby DeLuna.
Ruby DeLuna is features reporter for KUOW, and Kenji Lopez-Alt is a New York Times cooking columnist and author of the best-selling cookbooks The Food Lab and The Walk. So from eaters who love exploring their city, we then talk with some folks who turn Seattle's appetites into opportunities. We welcome Kara Martin of the Food Innovation Network and Chef Terry Nye. It's coming up. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber.
Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. Our show today was taped in front of a live audience in Seattle, one of the great food cities in America. We welcome Kara Martin, the program director at the Food Innovation Network, who helps to run Spice Bridge, a food hall for immigrant and refugee chefs. And joining us was one of those chefs, Terry Nye, the chef of Terry Cambodian Foods. And I started by asking Kara what Spice Bridge is and how it got started.
So Spice Bridge is the home to our food incubator. We are part of the nonprofit Global to Local, and the program that we're part of is the Food Innovation Network. And so our work really spans across the food system and really like community being the heart of that. And so Spice Bridge is a physical space where you can go and support immigrant and refugee women-owned businesses that are getting launched and started, like Terry here tonight.
As an aside, it's right by the airport. Go check it out.
But tell me, so how did the idea start? Because you said it actually started, the idea came from the immigrant communities that you work in, right? So how did it actually begin?
It started back in 2010, 2012. There was various community food projects going on in South King County where we're based, and at Global to Local, they had brought on Jambi Gushuru, who is here tonight. She's amazing. And she was doing outreach, and she was talking to folks about health equity and the challenges that they faced on a daily basis and barriers that they had to lead healthy lives. And when she pushed a little further to learn about what would make things better for you, obviously, if you have more money in your pocket, it's easier to lead a healthier life. And pushed even further, what does that look like? And she continually heard across many different cultural communities a very strong interest in people wanting to start food businesses, but a lot of people that already were cooking out of apartment kitchens and selling among one another. And so we realized there's something here. And that's where we started to dig a little more. And in 2017, we actually started piloting this project before we got into our pretty food hall in Tukwila.
Right on. And who are some of the people you were working with? Did you get a chance to taste their food and interview them and talk with them? Who are the people that you're
do this? Dozens. And the fun thing is we've done these up until the pandemic. We did these community kitchen nights where it really gave them an opportunity to bring people together and learn different dishes and be in the kitchen together. And so that was a real opportunity to really talk and see the talent and the skill that people also had. Mm-hmm. And also hear that people wanted to share their dishes with other communities, and that it really there's so much commonality that you can find just through food, even if the food is different than what you're used to eating.
Oh, that's so interesting. Let me turn to Terry first of all, Terry, I had a chance to pop by your place at Spice Bridge yesterday, and it was so delicious. It was so good, and I just couldn't stop. I couldn't stop eating. It was really good. So thank you for that. But I want to turn to you because you have this fascinating story about how you got interested in cooking, which is by saying to me first, "Oh, I hate cooking." You came here in 1985 as a refugee from Cambodia. Yeah. And you said your family, in particular your mother, was a wonderful cook, and she cooked for different community members. She was sort of put in the position of being the community cook. Yeah. And you sort of resented that. It sort of took her time and attention away from you. So how did you learn to cook? And tell me about how food worked in the community you lived in.
Well,
I hated cooking, so because it's too much work, and I get asked to help, and I don't like peeling garlic. So I'm sure all of you guys have that too. But even if I didn't like cooking, I do love her food.
Yeah.
So that's always been my memory of my mother. And when I started to cook, when I have my own kids, of course, I have to raise them. And so I start cooking for them. And then once in a while, I have time, I will invite friend over for dinner. And they will say, you know, this, you actually cook good. You know, you should have a restaurant. I'm like, yeah, I know. There's no Cambodian food here in Washington. And if they do it, they don't use the right ingredients. Like, they're so mild out for, like, And so my friend's like, well, then this should be you. You know, having a Cambodian restaurant. I was like, yeah, whatever. It's, I mean, it was too difficult to be in the food industry. Back in the day, it was not enough resources for us to know to do so. But as time goes by, the community that my mother used to cook for Cambodian seniors, this is where, when we first came to the United States, we don't speak the language, and they always meet at the temple. So this is how they form a way to cope in a new country.
Yeah.
And so as she gets older and she can't cook anymore, so the program just kind of failed. And like 3 years ago, my friend called me up and said, hey, Terry, you know, I'm starting a Cambodian senior. They need their social life. I need you to be the chef. And I'm like, I hate cooking. I remember those days. I am not cooking for no one. I remember those mess. My mom yelled at me for not helping. I'm not doing that. And so he said, well, just do it. Do it for your parents' legacy. I'm like, so, and that's how it all started. Just, and I was like, so I was like, oh, fine, anything for my parents. Okay, since they're not here anymore. So that's how it all started. I was the chef at the senior place. Some of my mom's friend that came, they asked for dishes that I never cooked before. But I've eaten before from my mother. And so they have, we had a Cambodian New Year event. And long story short, I got them all together. And so the mealtime came and start serving. And at the end of the serving time, I went around and to a few ladies and I asked, so how do you like it? Because it's my first time, I want to know, you know. And so one of the ladies said, you know, Terry, one bite of this, it took me back when the first time I had it. And that was before the wartime.
Oh, God.
And I planned to cook for my children. But because the war happened, and now that I'm in the United States, I'm too old to cook. So I've never got a chance to cook for my kids this dish. So, so that's how, one, it validated that I can cook that dish. and second, it's just how this is where it actually wakened me up on how important traditional food is. That especially for country that has gone through stuff like that, that they lost a lot of their traditionals and their physical, their ways.
Yeah.
And when you have something like this, it's when they tell you, you're kind of like, wow, it's actually that important. And it actually makes them that happy. And it brings back that happy memory. So that's, now I find it so important to keep Cambodian traditional culture, our original dish, our culture dish.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, that they're missing.
You know, I come from an immigrant family, and and obviously, you know, I'm in food. I'm really interested in food, and like, you know, a lot of my conversations with people in my family and in general are about like, oh, how food works in immigrant communities, right? Like how so often it is an incredibly important part of people's.
Have you heard that food is an important part of people's lives?
But you know, in the life of a community, because for people who are physically removed from where they grew up, from you know where they learned everything they know about how the world works, there are certain things that are like immediate and like you can actually that reminds you of how you were raised and you know your values and your culture and those things. And so like people hold on to their food really tightly, often, not always. But hearing you speak, it really strikes me how much more powerful that must be for a community that comes from a place where the place they left essentially no longer exists. It's not buying a plane ticket and seeing how things are. So, but I also love what you said. You spoke to it just now. The other day you said to me, like, you can't find Cambodian food here in Washington unless you have Cambodian friends. And you'd actually noted, even if there is a Cambodian restaurant, often it'll be sort of positioned as Asian fusion food. It's mm-hmm. not like people who are really claiming their Cambodian or Khmer heritage. And you said, I wrote this down, what is happening to my culture?
Yep.
So this is my passion now. And you just spoke really beautifully about needing to preserve these elements of your tradition, but you also put your own spin on the dishes, right? So the dish I was eating, rice noodles with chicken, fried garlic, some greens, Chinese broccoli, and almost like a gravy type of sauce, a light sauce that tastes a little bit sweet like coconut.
Yeah.
And remind me the name of the dish, I'm sorry.
Well, there's two ways we can call this. It's based on the noodles.
Okay.
The shape of the noodles. One of them is called migatang, which is made with a white noodle. And then the one that I serve you, it was the triangle mm-hmm. noodle, but it is the same style. So I wanted to just kind of share that you might not know Cambodian food, but at the same time, we are diverse as anyone else too. And we can use whatever accessible ingredients and make that into that traditional flavor dish.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's also in sharing with my own culture that happened to have only with the white noodle and never had it with the triangle noodle.
Mm-hmm.
So I want them to also learn that, hey, you can use different noodles for the same style. So
yeah.
I wanted to like kind of help like get into a broader way to make their food. So I added toppings, as my cousin calls me, extra. she helps me once in a while, and I say, wait, let me see the dish. And she's like, but it's good now. I'm like, no, I need all my herbs on top of it. I need my fried garlic. I need my chili oil. I need all of this to be in it because I don't want my customer to wonder when they're eating the food if they like the food so much. But then you're like a spicy person and you're like, oh, it would be so good if it had some pepper in here. I don't want that to happen to my customer. So what I do is I complex everything. I pack everything into one dish. So this way, you now just focus on the dish, the flavor, the taste, and have that great experience without wondering what if, what if, what if.
Yeah.
So
that's... No. Believe me, no one eats your dish like,
that
what if.
That is my twist.
But you're doing this even though your passion and your mission in some ways is to preserve tradition. I think one of the things that actually keeps tradition alive is not freezing it in amber and letting it change and letting it evolve and giving yourself the right to do that.
Yeah.
You know, I think that is something that's so important because oftentimes, in particular, when we go to restaurants that speak to a certain culture or speak to a certain community, or maybe we sort of make them, we want to make them speak for that culture.
Yeah.
And we want to make sure that, oh, this has to be the most quote-unquote authentic way to make that. And it's like, well, why do we let you know, chef blah, 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 be creative all day long, but not let the chef from this country be creative? Why do we think the highest form of food from a brown person is quote-unquote authenticity, but the highest form of food from someone else is creativity? So I think that idea of being motivated by your tradition and deeply motivated by your tradition, but giving yourself the creative freedom to add new flavor and new taste that you like is super important. So thank you for doing that.
That was Kara Martin of the Food Innovation Network and Chef Terry Nye of Terry Cambodian Foods. And if you're in Seattle, go check out Spice Bridge. And whatever you do, do not leave that city without a bottle of Terry's homemade chili oil. It's incredible. And our next guests were Angela Dunleavy and Carlin Llorente of Fair Start, a 30-year-old organization that serves meals to the hungry and helps people break the cycle of poverty with job and life skills training. And we started by asking Angela how Fair Start got started.
Fair Start was founded actually under the name Common Meals, and it was founded by a chef. His name's David Lee. If you enjoy Field Roast or ever have in your life, he went on to found Field Roast. But essentially, he started Fair Start as a way to feed the community, feed individuals who are living in shelter. And that evolved into then how does one work with the people who are in that shelter to learn the kitchen skills to then go and get a job in the restaurant industry. And so that's really how Fair Start was started. Over the last 30 years, we've trained thousands of individuals, youth and adults, to work in the culinary field, and plus, as Carlin likes to say, because we do place a lot of folks in grocery and different food service industries. But that's sort of the Fair Start way, and I have a long history in the Seattle restaurant scene, and so it was sort of a match made in heaven for me to go to Fair Start for my next career pivot. Yeah.
And you started there in 2018.
I did. Yeah.
So how has it evolved since you got there?
Well, I was there in the before times.
Yeah.
So, you know, when we saw COVID happening, and we saw it here first.
Right.
I remember, you know, calling and talking to restaurant friends in Philly and in Boston, and they thought we were being a little bit hysterical out here. Of what was going on. And we realized very quickly that downtown was clearing out and things shut down very shortly after. And Fair Start at the time had two full restaurant kitchens, a catering kitchen, a school meals kitchen, and our community meals kitchens. And we really just pivoted completely to provide meals to those most in need, those who were in the quarantine sites, those who were continuing our shelter meals, and those living in permanent supportive housing to keep transmission levels low. And, you know, we're still in some version of the pandemic, I guess. But since March of 2020, we've produced 5 million meals for residents of the county. And job training. So we're still doing that, too. So.
Right. That's incredible. But, okay, so I mean, you came, as you mentioned, you had a long and illustrious career. You were the CEO of one of the most lauded restaurant groups in Seattle. You come to Fair Start in 2018, and in part because of the pandemic, but also in part, I think, because of your vision. Like, you didn't emphasize restaurants as much in terms of the programming, like sort of like leading into the pipeline of restaurants. So it's a little funny that, like, oh, like, we brought in this restaurateur, who's the person who's like, maybe we do things other than restaurants too.
Yeah, well, you know, I think we talk about what, you know, the secret sauce of Fair Start, and it's really obvious, I think, if you meet a Fair Start graduate or you have a chance to engage either as a volunteer, or many of you in the audience may have been at Guest Chef Night, which was where we would bring chefs in from different restaurants around town. And I think that what really is what makes Fair Start is the self-empowerment sort of skill. I don't know if it's quite a skill, but, you know, those human skills, those some people call them soft skills, but really living this self-empowerment. And now we focus a lot on financial literacy, technical literacy, managing conflict, and knowing what your values are and what kind of employer you want to work for. And I think that's especially important now as we've seen a bit of a reckoning in the restaurant industry, and people need to know, you know, who they're working for and how do you land in a restaurant job, which is a very forgiving industry, a very forgiving, low-barrier job, but how do you go somewhere and make sure that you're working for someone that won't exploit you and abuse you? And I think that's really important in the work that we do at Fairstart, because we work with people who, you know, have been incarcerated for a long time, have experienced homelessness, have faced systemic barriers, and we have a pretty keen eye on making sure that program participants who leave, whether our virtual program or have been working in our kitchens, go to places and to employers who have reputations for treating their people well.
We're bringing you a live show we recorded in Seattle a few months back. More in a minute from Angela Dunleavy and Carlin Llorente of Fairstart. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. Our show is supported by Hero Bread. You know, for a lot of us, bread has been a staple all our lives. Toast at breakfast, sandwiches at lunch, a nice buttered roll at dinner. It's comforting and delicious, and bread is often what we crave. But sometimes, it can sit a little heavy after a meal. That's where Hero Bread comes in. They've created fluffy, delicious versions of the breads that we're used to, but that include no net carbs, 0 grams of sugar, and fewer calories. Oh, and there's more good stuff too, like protein and fiber. Hero Bread has everything from your daily sandwich loaf to tortillas or hot dog and hamburger buns. The products are flavorful and they have something for every craving, from a dressed-up breakfast burrito to a late-night PB&J. They even have monthly small-batch drops of indulgent treats like 2-gram net-carb Hero Croissant or the 1-gram net-carb Hero Cheddar Biscuit. Don't give up being a breadhead. Hero Bread is offering 10% off your order. Go to hero.co and use code TABLE at checkout. That's TABLE at hero.co. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for curious cooks and eaters. We're coming to you from Seattle today with an event we did with public radio station KUOW a couple months ago, and we were on a mission to talk to some of the people who make Seattle such an incredible food community. Coming back into a conversation I had with Angela Dunleavy and Carlin Llorente of Fairstart, a 30-year-old organization that serves meals to the hungry and helps people break the cycle of poverty with job and life skills training.
It's weird, right? Like, the restaurant world is, like you said, it's a very forgiving place in a lot of ways. It is a low barrier of entry. It is a place where many people who, I mean, the cliche of like, oh, before food was cool, like you worked in restaurants because it was the only place you could go if you weren't like, you know, if you were not sort of in a typical white collar track or whatever. And so in a lot of ways, there is this wonderful community and community building there that is about like, hey, just come here and we're going to do this work together and we're going to like, you know, we're going to, you know, get through a Saturday night together and we're all bonded because, you know, we're in the trenches together. And there is this actually really wonderful side of it. And it's been 20 years since I worked in a restaurant. And there are moments all the time where I just think back to those moments and think like, I don't experience that anywhere else in my life right now. Right. Like, so there's a really amazing thing that can happen there. At the same time, those of us who've worked in restaurants have always known there are dark sides of the industry. It's rife with potential for abuse, substance abuse, labor abuse, and all kinds of bad behaviors. And so I have wondered, oh, for programs that are working with people who are systemically disadvantaged, who have probably experienced trauma, who are in lots of ways vulnerable, like, how do you responsibly put them into a workplace where sometimes people are preyed upon?
Yeah. I think that it speaks to our staff that work with each student in that job placement and being really honest. Like, if you are fresh in your recovery, maybe going into a restaurant that has a well-known bar program and is known for sort of late nights and that restaurant party culture isn't a great place for you. I think we're lucky in Seattle. I know, you know, most communities around the country have like that really great local grocery store chain. Mm-hmm. We have several of them in Seattle that have been wonderful places. You know, the co-op markets that have just been really terrific places for our graduates to go and work and experience a consistent schedule.
Yeah.
Health insurance. you know, other benefits, vacation, and good pay. And so we've really looked at, you know, what are the other jobs in the food sector? And there are so many jobs in the food sector that don't just involve, you know, prepping and being a line cook or in a restaurant. And they do include grocery and warehousing and logistics. And, you know, we have a very big food system in the Northwest. And so we've started to really think about how we not only can place individuals into the best restaurants, if that's where they want to go, but in other food sectors. And then between all of that, how do we then help folks see the transferable skills that can take them completely out of the sector, which is, I think, probably the thing that people talk about the least is, you know, it's kind of it's a bit of a young person's game, the restaurant industry, because it's really hard on your body too.
Sure.
All the other things aside, you're on your feet for a lot of hours, and that's not something that is sustaining into your oftentimes 50s, 60s.
Sure. So Carlin, let me turn to you as the chief program officer. Tell us about how you've continued to, like, when you couldn't have, when people weren't gathering and restaurants were closed, and you were still providing, like, knife skills training to people, like, how'd you do that, and how have you pivoted, and how have you, what do you think the future holds?
Best practices in virtual knife skills is still something we're working on. for folks that have supported Fair Start in the past, there have been opportunities to be involved in some knife skills training. We're not going to be auctioning that item off anytime soon at a gala. But to your point, like in those very early days, as Angela described, there was a huge pivot and everything went into hunger relief. Everything went into contract meals and making sure the community was fed. And for a short time, there was a pause in Fair Start's 30-year history of training people. 8,000 people, more than 8,000 people have been trained through Fair Start over the years. And so it meant a lot. And so it meant a lot. 30 years and 8,000 people to pause was very significant. And so as soon as we could as an organization, there was an attempt to do exactly the same kind of culinary training that we'd been doing for 30 years, except on Zoom, which was, so there were knife rolls and there were vegetable boxes sent out to participants' homes or places of shelter. Yeah, exactly, because many of our participants are fresh from experiences that are not, you know, single-family housing. Mm-hmm. And it ended up not being as powerful. You know, doing knife skills virtually was not as important as doing technology skills, as doing customer service skills, as doing financial literacy, as doing career development training. And so the heart of our virtual training these last couple of years has been on these other skills. And, you know, instead of getting a knife roll at Fair Start these days, you get a computer. And you... Yeah, because it's to the point that you both have been discussing, you know, those computer skills are going to serve you the rest of your career, whether it's in the kitchen or in a different part of the food system. Mm-hmm. And so that's become the foundation, these self-empowerment skills and these technology navigation skills. And it's been paying off really well. We've maintained a very high placement and our graduates have stayed in jobs. You know, even despite the pretty radical reshift in what the training looks like these days.
Yeah. Tell me about the sort of like, maybe what Angela is referring to, the soft skills or like the social emotional skills. Like if you're dealing with, you know, participants who were incarcerated, you know, and, you know, as we know, recidivism rates in our country are astronomical. How do you work with that side of people's, how do you work with that side of things and help people get into a place where like, hey, I feel worthwhile. I feel like I can walk into a workplace and I feel like I know how to protect myself if the workplace is not appropriately treating me.
Yeah, developing that sense of self-worth and dignity and meaning and purpose is at the heart of what we do. And so it begins with meeting people exactly where they are, wherever that happens to be. And so if you have been living homeless for a number of years, if you've been incarcerated for the last 15 years, as a member of our last cohort was, and hadn't ever had an email address or a computer or any kind of connection to people that was safe, you start by meeting them where they are and by affirming that they do have inherent worth and dignity as people. And so, you know, putting people in a circumstance where they're seen, and where they're heard and where they get to belong and connect and learn and develop skills that, that get to practice every day, it has a really compounding effect. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't take that long. Our current virtual program, and we've got a lot of program ideas in the hopper, and we can talk about those later maybe, but the current virtual program we've been running has been very successful at 6.5 weeks. Because given, you know, a 5-day schedule and the skills that we're trying to focus on, we've had really high success rates with that kind of experience. And it's amazing what can happen when you meet people where they are and show them that there's a way forward and support them in walking that path.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for doing that work. And I mean, let's talk about it now. What is on the horizon?
Oh, it's exciting. So we learned a couple things in the pandemic, and one thing is that the virtual program has a place in our program repertoire. There will be a virtual program for Fair Start, I think, going forward, that will continue to reach people. We were able to reach more custodial parents in pandemic than we were able to before because the commute and distance limitations were erased. Mm-hmm. We were able to reach a more representative sample of our community in some cases than we have before. So there's a place for virtual and on-the-job skills training, you know, in person is really something valuable and important too. And so, you know, this summer we'll welcome folks back into the Fair Start social enterprises, the hunger relief and the food recovery. And so for the time being, those are the businesses. We don't have a restaurant that's currently operating for COVID reasons. We don't have some of the catering operations we've had. So we have a ton. The 5 million meals that Angela described are the place where we're going to help our program participants, our students, get their first experience of on-the-job training. And so, you know, we'll be welcoming folks back this summer. And 6 months later, we'll have our first graduates from our new in-person program.
Right on.
I will add, please, though, because one of the things that we started doing during COVID that I'm really excited about, yeah, continuing, and this might be news to Carlin, I don't know, probably not.
She's always looking to make news.
Right. We have started working with employers. So we know that we can't do all of the on-the-job training at Fair Start, and we certainly can't do that if we want to do what Carlin said and meet people where they are, which might not be working in a restaurant or food service of any kind, but they want to go work in warehousing, and we have some, you know, amazing food companies here that we've had some students go and spend time in and get hired, and it's almost like providing a job coach, or I like to call it like a temporary support in employment. Mm-hmm. So that first 90 days is you're getting in and getting to know the job, and that big life change that happens as you're getting to know a new employer. And so we've been piloting for the last year, supporting a handful of students in that and working, you know, with their manager, their supervisor to set goals every week and providing them with the, you know, light case management that they might need in their first couple of months on the job, and really helping to educate employers of, like, in the restaurant industry, like a no-call, no-show is like, you're,
yeah,
just,
that's like,
done.
Yeah, yeah, just, yeah. You're dead to me.
Yeah, you're just done.
But
when really understand why it happens, it's not what, I think even as a restaurateur, it's not what I would have thought, right? Like, you think no call, no show, like, they're irresponsible, they are out partying, they're doing whatever. Oftentimes it's transportation, childcare, you know, family care, or they feel like they messed up the day before, and rather than face, they've never been successful in facing positive criticism. There's never, mm-hmm, been, you know, positive coaching. So they just leave. And so it's really been great to see what happens when you can coach someone to stay. And we've had some success with young people that we had one kid who left. It was Mod Pizza's great locally based fast casual restaurant. He left for 2 weeks, no call, no showed, And we tracked him down through, like, an Xbox game. His case manager found him. Like, yeah, parents know. I know. This is why I have chat disabled for my kids, because, yeah. Like, the fact that you can be easily accessible. But we ended up finding him through, like, his Xbox game and convinced him to come back into work, give it another try, talk through what had happened that challenged him. And he stayed at MOD for almost 2 years.
Amazing. Yeah. You know, it's funny, because in my questions I'd prepared, one of them I was going to ask you is, what are the things you've learned on this job that you wish you knew when you ran your own restaurants? And I kind of feel like you just answered that.
Yeah, that's a big one. Yeah. That's a big one. There's so much going on in people's lives and so much trauma, and I think the pandemic has really laid that bare. But even, you know, what happens to people when they experience trauma, and then you go on and work in, like, a really intense kitchen line, which, I mean, anyone who's worked in restaurant, the kitchen line is just, I mean, it is, it can be brutal, and it's just really, really stressful. And I remember hearing conversations, you know, around, like, oh, that person couldn't hack it in the kitchen.
Sure, or, sure, sure.
You know, like, you know, these are the conversations that end up happening, unfortunately. But when I think about, like, I wonder why that, like, was it, like, what was happening for that person?
Yeah.
Like, what trauma was triggered? And could I have handled that differently or better as an employer? Those are the things I think that really kind of come to mind for me now, and how I would handle things differently.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really, at the end of the day, it's like, oh, we feel like we have these intense connections with our colleagues in the restaurant world, but, like, how human are those connections? Right? And that's kind of what we're talking about. It's like, oh, when you have truly a sense of the humanity of the person, and not just, oh, our connection is a connection of mutual trauma.
Yeah.
But, like,
yes.
it's really about, like, yes. Oh, how human is our connection at the end of the day? Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Angela Dunleavy is the CEO of Fair Start, and Carlin Llorente is their chief program officer. And that is our show. We obviously only scratched the surface of the food community of Seattle, but what a place. Thanks to all of our guests for coming, and thanks especially to KUOW for having us. We'll be back with you next week. APM Studios are run by Chandra Kavati, Alex Schaffert, and Joanne Griffith. Beth Perlman's our executive producer, and The Splitting Table was created by Sally Swift and Lynn Rosetto Casper. It's made every week by technical producer Jenny Lupke, producer Erica Romero, digital producer James Napoli, and managing producer Sally Swift. I'm Francis Lamb, and this is APM Studios.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.